What I want to do is to kind of set the scene for the conversation. What happens after 2015? What's happened in post-Paris, but also the SDGs, Sendai? A lot happened last year. A lot of things were kicked off. And looking through how that might change the ability of tackling climate change and security. But since Paris, I've been going around talking to colleagues in governments around Europe, in the US, in China, to see where they think the processes are, how far we've moved forward, also with think tanks and NGOs. I take responsibility for the judgments in the presentation, but and at the UN, but they are informed and trying to get a feel for where we are post the G7 process, post Paris. So I'm going to reflect a bit on the outcomes and what they mean for security, reflect a bit on the last 10, 15 years of climate security and resilience work, which we've been involved in inside and outside government, and what we've been good at, what we've been failing at, but really focus and leave on a discussion of what might be some of the paths forward, which I think will be the real focus of where we're going. So, and the summary, Paris made us safer, but not safe. And so we need to keep that in mind, that the climate risk implied by Paris is still unmanageable by any plausible adaptation or security response. So we need to have increased mitigation in 2020, and that is a security requirement. Climate change is impacting security, and we won't go through all of these, but most of the predictions which were made about how it impacted will impact geopolitics and security concerns and instability have come to pass, actually rather quicker than we thought, all of us who were doing this analysis 10 or 15 years ago. And I think we should reflect on that. This wasn't, it hasn't been unpredictable, that's precisely where it goes, but the broad themes and stresses and the management challenges have been relatively predictable. So, but actually, climate change is happening faster and in more extreme ways than expected. So the science, you won't see this, but science is constantly getting worse, but no one's telling you because they just rebase it. But compared to, say, when I started working on climate change, the predictions of climate change are more faster with more impacts. And sometimes, again, it can get lost because it's not the way scientists report what they do. Security responses, however, are lagging. There's been a lot of awareness, not a lot of response. We'll go into that a lot. But there are a new wave of reforms and a lot of issues from Sendai to the SDGs, to the G7, to Paris itself, which included a very controversial issue on environmental migration in it, which was quite a surprise. There was a lot more on adaptation and impacts and loss and damage than people expected in the Paris text, partly because the main negotiations were about something else. A lot of things snuck in, which people weren't watching, if you talk to the French negotiators. But actually, dealing and delivering those requires reform, which means moving. That's not just changing the current system, putting new things in the old system. We need to change the systems. And that requires political and diplomatic work. And that's what I want to finish on. And who's going to drive these reforms? Because if you don't have someone championing, you're not going to get that. So we do a lot of work on climate diplomacy and scenarios for governments and NGOs and foundations. And Paris kind of overachieved against our expectations going in, and we've been monitoring the politics for 10 years, quite detailed way. We have strong legal force and political backing of the agreement, much stronger than people expected. All countries will limit emissions. We have stronger goals, well below 2 degrees, efforts to reach 1.5. 5-yearly cycles of ambition to ratchet up a new goal of new greenhouse gas neutrality, the net zero in the second half of the century. And critically, it puts adaptation and resilience on an equal footing to mitigation. So we like to say we've now got a climate risk management regime rather than the mitigation regime that occasionally talked about adaptation. And that's quite important. And that regime's not just the UNFCCC, it's all the other institutions that get mandates from that process and from related processes. So the regime has changed. And the regime, that shape, that geometry, will last for 20 to 30 years. We spent lots of time negotiating the shape of the regime in terms of who does what. The Paris framework is durable. We will argue a lot about what we do inside it, but we won't be arguing about the shape of the regime, the hybrid top-down, bottom-up approach. And that's good, because it means we were talking about real-world things and not abstract principles like common but differentiated responsibilities. Well, what's it going to deliver? This is a graph. The purple line is a 2-degree trajectory without negative emissions, because I don't like negative emissions, over the year. We did gaming with negotiators in 2011-12 and asked them what might be the offers. So the green triangle was business as usual in 2030. The little crosshatch piece was the best possible negotiated outcome, which negotiators gaming together thought would be in Paris. Well above the 2-degree pathway, was the best we thought could come out of Paris. The INDC offers are pretty much in the middle. So in terms of ambition for abatement, we got a kind of mid to low outcome based on the politics, but everybody underpitched, so expect people to overdeliver. China's already said it's going to overdeliver. Europe will overdeliver. Most countries will do more than they said, partly because they changed their numbers just before Paris to make them less. But we're still on a 3 to 3.5 warming trajectory, even with that overdelivery. So again, we can argue about the precise numbers, but there's more work to do. But what does that mean for security? This is a scenario structure we used in our work called Degrees of Risk, and it's trying to look at how, if we're aiming for a 2-degree world, this is based on that, what are the things that might affect the outcome? And there are two main axes for us all: climate sensitivity, how sensitive the climate is, low or high on the y-axis, and successful or failed mitigation policies. So that can mean we agreed to do something and failed, or we failed to agree. So successful mitigation policies imply cooperation. They imply a kind of global response at some level. Failed ones imply a lack of global cooperation, which will extend to lack of global cooperation on resilience and security. So we're assuming these aren't two separate boxes. And the Paris outcome for us is kind of in that cloud. So we think climate sensitivity is higher than expected, so it's on the high side. So we have to, we can't do anything about that. That's a revealed fact of the world. And we are kind of halfway in, perhaps a bit low half into where we need to be to successful mitigation. And we characterize that with a low end of 3 degrees, with if we don't breach tipping points, a high end of 5 degrees, because there are quite a high probability of systemic tipping points. But crash response. Why crash response? Because in a basic cooperative scenario, as things get revealed as being worse, we will do more mitigation and we will work together harder on security. But they will be reactive responses rather than preemptive response. They will be quite disruptive, they will be rushed, how they work out. If cooperation holds, if the world turns to be less cooperative, if there's US-China tension dominates things, we could fall into more collapse and competition where people are scrabbling around for bits and they leave parts of the world like Africa and Middle East to just get on with it, which is under the scenarios we're talking about here, they would not be viable towards the end of the century as for the populations there. So that's the way we frame it, to say what more we need to do and how we need to think about the risks. And I think the MENA migration crisis, and we'll probably come back to this, shows the complexity of the responses. We've had a 1-in-900-year drought for the last 10 years. We've got a whole set of mixed drivers for complexity, for driving instability and social unrest, but now that's turned into full-scale regional rivalry, a very poor response from Europe, which is causing huge political stresses in Europe. So the political stresses in Europe, because of the migration crisis, are undermining our ability to respond to the root causes in North Africa and the Middle East, because they're dominating, people, far-right parties being elected. And we're also facing the impacts of low oil prices on causing instability, which is driven partly by climate policy, on the countries that weren't destabilized as much by the current peace in the same region. So there's no sustainable security without addressing climate and resource issues in forward planning, but I can tell you from talking to people in governments, none of that is in the current plans. Basically, we will wait to burn itself out and then we'll see what to do, but people are on week-to-week planning, basically dominated by ISIL, in a hard security dynamic, and NATO is dominated by dealing with Russia on Eastern Europe. But that's normal. The normal, in this volatile world, which we expect, not just because of climate change, but because of lots of other reasons, the space for long-term preventative measures gets crowded out in the system unless you keep it there. And that is the reality of where we are. So that's the kind of, where we are now in the real world. But we have made progress. I mean, this is this is the kind of people who have climate security in their security strategy. So people are aware of climate change and impacts on security. There's a green is kind of national security threat. So large number of countries, including China, vulnerabilities are high. And again, this is from the insurance industry. It's Munich Re, insurance damage. Actually, Europe is one of the least at risk domestically, at risk from climate impacts. But the US has a huge proportion of global damage, quite well insured. Asia, large amount of global damage, not very well insured. But again, these are big numbers, and people are starting to become aware of the vulnerability from extreme events. And this was a recent poll on what is your biggest risk. And climate risk came out as the biggest risk in most of the emerging economies, whereas Australia seems to be worried about ISIS. I'm not quite sure why Australia is worried about ISIS. Countries close to China are worried about China. Countries close to Russia are worried about Russia. But yes, we're all worried about ISIS, and Australia is too. But a lot of people are worried about climate change. So again, that locus of who cares, for years it was like the Europeans care. Actually, Europe's probably got one of the least sophisticated and aware discussions on climate risk and impacts. We can come to that later. It's got cultural roots. But there is definitely, you know, day to day, talking to policymakers, they know they can't get the development in place without looking at climate change in most emerging economies. It's much, because it's day to day for them. It's real, you know, coupled with things like El Nino, it really makes a difference. But attention has not led to action. You know, we've worked with the UK government, whose foreign policy advisor happened to be my co-founder of E3G at the time, to get the UN Security Council debate in 2007, which is the kind of big public beginning of this. And the EU had a climate security strategy, and there were country initiatives in UK and Germany, and the US did a lot, and NATO talked about it a bit, and the EU talked about it a lot. And to be honest, apart from the US, partly because of mandates coming through Congress, and there was some bit of machinery, especially in DoD, that's pretty much led to nothing operational happening on the ground anywhere. Apart from a bit of equipment manufacturing, risk assessments and basing assessments in the UK. And we can come back to why that is. So awareness was there, speeches were made, initiatives were launched, strategies were written, but they didn't actually land in operations. But we've got another wave coming through. That was that first wave. We've got a new wave coming through Sendai and now the World Humanitarian Summit. The G7 has set up extreme weather insurance, a goal for an extra 400 million people to be covered. That could be a huge risk reduction, social conflict prevention device if focused in the right way. If we looked at that, it's not got as much coverage as it should do, I think. The Global Financial Stability Board is looking at systemic risk from climate change impacts and transition. We've got the SDGs integration into all development and international public funding and the Paris commitments. It's coming through a frame of resilience rather than security and political analysis, and that is a bit of a problem because it's framed in a very technocratic way, and those bits of resilience that require social responses and governance and therefore politics, again, it seems to be slightly edited out, but again, that's, you know, there is, it's not that, it's just, it's an opportunity to make sure it is done the right way. And we have the national security initiatives like the G7, State Department process integrating climate change. The EU has a global strategy review, which reports in the middle of this year. The Netherlands are running a planetary security conference process. The Swedes are looking at it. Canadians are looking at it in their foreign ministries. So again, political interest growing, capacity, if you look underneath each of these initiatives, the actual bureaucratic capacity and budgets to deliver are not there yet. So, and just other things are happening. So other people are limiting their risk, including to the political stresses caused by climate change. And the quiet movement post the Thailand floods and the 2007, the 8-9 crisis, is the private sector is reducing its supply chains, tightening up, focusing on resilient countries. That is not good for development. That is, no, there's some really bad, but it's perfectly logical if you're a private sector actor that that's the way you limit your risk, you limit your exposure, by not putting supply chains through vulnerable regions. But of course, it lowers economic activity and reduces their capacity to respond. So, but this is, there's quite a lot of work going on in the private sector, driven by consultancies and insurance industry. Producing things like this, which is the Lloyd's City Risk Index. This is Southeast Asia, top issue, windstorms, then market crash, human pandemic, earthquake, flood. No, these are backward-looking, they're not forward-looking. These are just looking at the macro risks to these places. This is the kind of indices you use when you're looking to invest, but there's lots of others, that's just one. So that's where we think we are, but we think that means there's a big opportunity. We think the reality, but only if we grip it. And so some of the ideas we're looking for, we're going to put on the table for reform over the next 4 years. So we would like to see a more coherent reform process saying we need to integrate climate resilience throughout the UN and broader international system in the way we have done it with low carbon. So in a sense, the mitigation has kind of started to get that coherence. but we've not really looked at this as a real reform process as opposed to a set of individual pieces. And there's an opportunity with a new Secretary General, I think, to move that. We think there's a case, though we're always happy to argue about it, that if you're going to have institutional reform, someone needs to be in charge, and there's a place for a special envoy, an SG special envoy, to do that, and to think about how the UN Security Council and the General Assembly get updates on the impacts of climate change on UN, on peace, security, human rights, development. That's not the IPCC. That does not do that work. And no one currently does that, so whose job is that? Someone has to have the mandate to report there, like OCHA does, like we have on the Peace Building Committee. So there's kind of analogies in the system. But we need then for capacity. If you're going to, you know, if WHO and others and FAO are going to, who do they go to for climate advice? Again, it's not the IPCC. And we would like to see the UNFCCC Secretariat. You can argue UNEP could do it. There's arguments about where it sits. We need a capacity for risk assessment, for looking at tail risks, for looking at socioeconomic risks, for going beyond. Because we know unless someone's doing that, it's very hard for line ministry, implementing ministries to do it. So it makes sense as a horizontal function. That we need to ensure that conflict sensitivity is built on the other side into analysis of adaptation spending and prioritize governance building resilience. So we don't build the wrong dams that cause conflict. We don't build the wrong water systems that concentrate power and heighten ethnic tension. We don't ignore issues of land tenure when we're thinking about how we access different types of approach. We're working in Colombia on the hopefully post-peace plan process, doing environment and climate analysis of the peace plans to make sure that when people go back to the region, they go back to a sustainable governance system. And that's a very interesting practical task around building conflict sensitivity into environment and climate plans. We think to get people to realize what to do, to get over this issue of what do we do, what does this mean, we should focus on piloting integration of climate and energy and resource issues into some big resilience programs in fragile areas. And the obvious ones are North Africa, European lead priority, Mekong, US lead priority, and East Africa stroke Horn, Yemen. No one's priority at the moment. You can argue about whether that's, so unfortunately, too far gone to work on. But if you're looking at places which are live conflicts, which building peace requires you to analyze, those are the places. So let's do the big things in big places, important places, because that might get money to flow to them a bit more. And we think there's a real case for designing the extreme risk weather insurance schemes, which are currently underway and building in Africa and the Caribbean and the Pacific and Asia, to target some of them, build them to make sure they can target and deal with at conflict areas. At the moment, they're focused on economically productive areas, not the most at risk areas, and that's an area where we're currently researching. And the core theme of all of this is to reform the system so that the urgent, and there will be more urgent, because that's the way the world's going, doesn't displace the important. So we need to create places where people can do the medium to long-term work while the urgent is being managed, and understand people to understand why they need to do that in order to get out of the crises, which is have the head, and that's about capacity and headspace and budgets and institutional reform. And the last one, and it's going to say, okay, if it's a reform agenda, it requires to move budgets, it requires politics, because you never get, and top-down politics, because you never get budgets shifted without top-down politics. So some pieces here. Again, we think security actors need to take a bit more responsibility for why Paris works, and I mean Paris working by increasing mitigation in 2020. So we need security actors need to be stronger in pointing out the consequences of not increasing mitigation, which they haven't been as strong, but I think there's other actors like financial regulators, investors and cities, people with an interest in long-term stability, because their job requires keeping climate risk below a certain level to do their, to achieve their main task. And we're seeing a whole range of people there, and I think there's a broad issue there. How do we get that message to the mitigation community aside about the consequence of not managing climate change? Because I can tell you, they do not get it. They think it's a marginal percentage of GDP. They do not see it causing system failure. And how we're going to move to nearer, well below 2 and 1.5 unless they get that, is that's a critical issue. There's a real opportunity to move forward in international system reform. You know, what about making this one of the priorities for the new UN Secretary General and countries making it a priority for the candidates and signaling to the candidates they want to see follow-up of Paris and 2015 process as a priority in their pitches, and working with the High Ambition Coalition, which includes all the vulnerable countries, 140 countries, which we built at Paris, to deliver this reform as well as take forward the Paris Agreement and UNFCCC. We think there's a need for stronger US-EU cooperation, and there are discussions ongoing around that. There's a new climate change working group being set up. But if Europe wants to, Europe needs to show a bit of leadership, and we're failing. I mean, we're really politically failing in the North African region. And how do we engage other major countries? China is very worried too. Is this an area where we can build those bridges and use that? Because the core thing is, what's the coalition of countries who will back this change? Unless we can point to a coalition of countries who want to see these changes happen, we will always be in the margins. But again, I think this is, especially given the political timelines here, and then in Europe we have, France and Germany have elections in 2017. Always, but it's a chance to set mandates and set priorities, and this is a really interesting time, I think, with the new SG to think about how we get, if we think these reforms are necessary and important, how do we make sure they get on the top table agenda? Thank you.